are bigger than a bear.
What are you talking about?
That body that's sitting in your morgue right now. The one who everyone insists is Nola. Guess what I found when I put her fingerprints in the system?
Clearance issues.
Of course, clearance issues, Wags replied.
Zig expected as much. When you enlist in the military, your fingerprints go straight into the government's database. But as Zig had learned when he started working on the bodies of agents from the CIA, NSA, and every other acronym, when it comes to spies, high-level informants, or anyone else whose identity the government wanted to keep secret, their fingerprints got X'd out, meaning that only someone with the appropriate clearance could see who they actually were. This is where you tell me you've got clearance, Zig said.
I'm working on it. It'll take a few days. Fortunately for you, I'm an impatient person. And a nosy one.
Zig knew that tone. He stopped tapping his pencil. Wags, what did you find?
Just listen. Remember all those years ago, back when Bill Clinton was president and his Secretary of Commerce went down in a plane crash?
Ron Brown.
There you go, Wags said. 35 people died that night, but all the newspapers cared about was one person. VIP and presidential best friend Ron Brown. So, go back to today's bodies and the Alaska crash that took them down. Who's everyone currently focused on?
The VIP and presidential best friend.
Bingo.
Librarian of Congress Nelson Rookstuhl.
But
there were half a dozen other people on that flight, Zig said.
Correct again. Including your friend Nola, who, well, did you happen to see where she was stationed?
Sergeant First Class at Fort Belvoir, in Virginia.
Okay, but what did she do at Belvoir? What was her title there?
Nola was the artist in residence, Zig said. Wags paused. She shouldn't have been surprised. Based on what Zig said last night, he knew the girl.
You looked her up, Wags said.
I'd never heard of it before. Apparently, since World War I, the Army has assigned one person, an actual artist, who they send out in the field to, well, paint what couldn't otherwise be seen.
So instead of guns, they get brushes, Wags agreed, making Zig again think of the canvas,
the portrait that was taken from Nola's belongings.
What else you find?
It's apparently one of the greatest traditions in our military. They call them war artists, Zig said. They go, they see, they paint, cataloging every victory and mistake, from the dead on D-Day to the injured at Mogadishu to the sandbag pilers who were at Hurricane Katrina. In fact, when 9/11 hit, Nola's predecessor was the only artist let inside the security perimeter.
And you know why that matters? Zig asked. It means Nola is someone with access. She's not the only one. You take a peek at the names of the other victims who were on her flight?
There was a young soldier, Anthony Trudeau, Zig said, still seeing Anthony's mom with the dead look in her eyes, his dad lying on the Fisher House carpet. There were others, too, at least one Air Force. I'm guessing that was the pilot.
Pilot for sure. That's three soldiers total when you include Nola. And who else?
Zig didn't even hear the question. He was still thinking of Anthony's parents.
He needed to go by later, make sure they were okay. Come on, Zig, Wags added. There were three other people on that plane. The last three bodies carried off this morning.
The civilians,
Dino whispered, still kneeling at the vending machine. Zig turned to his friend. He didn't realize Dino had been listening and could hear everything the entire time. Civilians, Zig repeated, focusing back on the phone. There were three other civilians on board.
Exactly, Wags said.
Rookstuhl was the head of the Library of Congress. Of course he had staff with him.
Three aides. You catch their names?
That smelled to Zig, too. Their names still hadn't been released. They said they hadn't been able to reach the families yet, if you believe it.
Now you're seeing how the magic trick works. Everyone's so busy mourning presidential pal Rookstuhl, no one bothers to see who was sitting in the two rows behind him. Lucky for me, I work for the FBI,
which gave me access to the Plains 4 manifest. Wags, this is my solemn vow to you. Next time I see you, I have a hug with your name on it. Save your hugs. You're assuming this is good news, she said. According to the manifest, one of Rookstool's staffers was a woman named Rose Mackenberg. Then there were two men, Clifford Eddy Jr. and Amadeo Vaca. Interesting names. I thought the same. And when you looked them up? Zig asked. Amadeo Vaca, Clifford Eddy Jr., and Rose Mackenberg were all born in the late 1800s. From what I can tell, they've been dead for nearly half a century. Zig went silent. Dino glanced over his shoulder. Behind them, the door to the bowling alley opened, and two men walked in. Both in uniform. Young army cadets. Weird, right? Wags asked through the phone. But not as weird as this. Back when Mackenberg, Eddy, and Vaca were alive, they all worked in the same field of study. You'd almost call them experts. Experts in what? The ancient art of coming back from the dead. Zig was still staring at the cadets, who were just standing there, like they were waiting for someone. I didn't realize that was an actual field of study, Zig said. It was a passion of their boss, Wags explained. An obsession, really. Who was their employer? Dr. Frankenstein? Close, Wags said, her voice slowing down. Nearly 100 years ago? Rose Mackenberg, Clifford Eddy Jr., and Amadeo Vaca all worked for a man named Harry Houdini. 14. You know I hate magic. This isn't magic, Ziggy. It's about understanding who these people were, Wags said through the phone. Rose Mackenberg, Clifford Eddy Jr., Amadeo Vak, I heard you, Zig said, eyes still on the two soldiers at the entrance to the bowling alley. They died 50 years ago and worked for Houdini, which means someone's pulling a fast one here. More than you even realize. I put their names in the system. At 0800 this morning, the bodies of Mackenberg, Eddy, and Vaca were delivered to Dover. But guess what else I found? They died 5 years ago in a helicopter crash. And 4 years before that, not far from Stanford University, in an accident with an army Humvee. Fellas, Dino called out to the two soldiers, who were still just standing there. We're on break for an hour. Come back later. One soldier looked at the other, and they nodded their goodbyes, leaving the bowling alley. Wait, it gets better, Wags added. All three of them also died right after 9/11, when we invaded Iraq, and then again in the early 90s, when we first went after Saddam. Every decade, 70s, 80s, 90s, they're like one of those contemporary easy listening stations, but with dead bodies instead of James Taylor songs. I found records of them dying in Cambodia, Lebanon, even the Falkland Islands. Wags, I've worked on 2,356 bodies here, and not one of them has come back to life. So if you're trying to sound all spooky, you need to do it with something less trendy than zombies. I'm not talking zombies. You know what this is, Ziggy. Mackenberg, Eddy, and Vaca, I get it. They're cover names, Zig said, referring to the fake IDs that are used to hide the real identities of national security operatives. Zig saw them all the time. Usually, though, they go with something more low-key, like Andrew Smith. Exactly. But now you're seeing the problem. If they're purposefully using specific names like these, either they've got a good reason to use those names, or maybe the names are somehow associated with a particular undercover unit. Those happen more than you think. But to use the same names over and over, doesn't that just call attention to yourself? Not over and over. They did it every half decade or so. Plus, people are committed to their code names. A few years back, I had a supervisor who named all his confidential informants after characters in Stephen King books. So then what? If Mackenberg, Eddy, and Vaca all worked for Harry Houdini, we're looking for someone out there who's a magic fan? Again, This is more than magic. Everyone knows Houdini was the world's greatest escape artist. But as I was Googling him just now, you know what the number one thing was that he wanted to escape? Death. It was his obsession. On nearly every website I found, it said that when Houdini died, he was so determined to come back to life, he gave out secret code words to those closest to him. That way, if they tried to contact him during a seance, they'd know it was really him. Houdini's wife got a code, his brother too. And from what I can tell, so did Mackenberg, Eddie, and Vaca. They were the ones who were supposed to help him communicate from the great beyond. Sounds like a hell of a trick. Of course it's a trick. Everything with Houdini was for show. But his obsession with death? That was real. It started when his mother passed away. It wrecked him to his core. From that day forward, he became a walking corpse, putting on the biggest and best shows for the world. But deep down, he was so wounded by the loss, he pulled away from everyone around him. It was the one thing that the man with no fear was afraid of, opening himself up and risking pain like that again. Until the day he died, he would have given anything, truly anything, for one more chance to tell her that he loved her. Sound like anyone else you know? For a moment, Zig sat there motionless in the plastic bowling alley seat, staring at the polished pins at the end of the lane. "She's not very subtle, is she?" Dino asked from the vending machine, pretending to straighten a row of cookies but still clearly eavesdropping. "Tell Dino I'm being honest," Wags shot back. "Pay attention, Zig. Whatever's going on here, those other bodies, Mackenberg, Eddie, and Vaca, they weren't sightseeing on a teen tour. This was a plane full of secrets." "I don't care about secrets. What I care about is Nola, which is why top priority right now is seeing who comes to claim her body."
"You mean came?"
"Excuse me? I'm looking at the big board right now. According to this, they just moved Nola's body, or whoever's body it is. She got picked up 3 minutes ago." 15. They called this area departures, like it was an airport lounge, and everyone was sitting around, scrolling through their cell phones, waiting to take off to some exotic locale. Really, though, it was a warehouse, clean as a hospital, and long and wide enough to hold an 18-wheeler. On good days, it was mostly empty, except for a few caskets on display. Metal or wood, the government made you choose. And a large yellow sign with red letters. "Casketed remains must be flag-draped beyond this point." Sure enough, as Zig burst into the room, there was a lone coffin wrapped in a freshly pressed American flag. From the lower handle, a newly minted dog tag read, "Brown, Nola." "Don't you muss my flag," a woman in her mid-50s warned in a flat Indiana accent. "Who dressed her?" Zig challenged. "Zig, I'm serious. Don't muss it," said Louisa Lou Falwell, thinning brown hair, stocky round build, mesmerizing sky blue eyes, from her desk in the corner. Too late. With a yank, Zig tugged the flag from the shiny and freshly rubbed with pledge wooden coffin. The flag whipped into the air. Zig made sure it didn't touch the floor. Normal flags were 8x5. Coffin flags were bigger, more unwieldy, which made it drape like a cape over Zig's shoulder. Around the base of the coffin, the polyester elastic braid that held the flag in place still hugged tight. "Master Guns warned me you were getting emotional, but has your brain officially disappeared?" Louisa asked, pointing a stubby finger at Zig, but still not moving from her desk. As the head of departures, the final stop before each body got shipped back to its family, Louisa was well accustomed to dealing with people at their worst. As Dover's only female mortician, the one who played funeral with her Barbies, she also had a PhD in stubborn men. "I want to know who dressed her," Zig insisted. Before Louisa could answer, Zig flipped the latches at the head and foot of the casket. He knew which side was which. The stars of the flag always covered the soldier's heart. "Tunk, tunk." "Is she a relative?" Louisa asked. "Not a relative. Family friend," Zig replied as he lifted the lid of the casket. Inside, the woman ID'd as Nola, the woman from the painting. The woman Zig had worked on so painstakingly last night was flat on her back, in perfect prayer pose, her face tranquil. A clear plastic sheet protected her blue Class A dress uniform, with white gloves and dark socks, from any stray makeup that might rub off during the transfer to the funeral home. "Robbie did a good job," Louisa said, though she knew when it came to the final dressing of the dead, nothing was good enough for Zig. Reaching into the casket, Zig pulled aside the plastic, scanning Nola's uniform and each of her badges and cords. "You think we didn't do the full checklist?" Louisa asked. At Dover, there was a 26-item inspection list just for each casket. That didn't include the body or the checklist Zig himself had written. He focused on Nola's face, knowing how vital it was to get it right. Every parent, including Zig, needs to see the face to believe it's real. Now, her makeup was holding up nice. Her hair, too. Last night, Zig had washed it himself, then washed it again. As one of his predecessors put it, the mother of the deceased is the first to wash a soldier's hair. You get to be the last one to wash it. From his pocket, Zig pulled out the small 6-inch ruler he carried with him every day on the job. He measured from the seam of her shoulder down to the tip of the chevron stripes that marked her years of service. 5 inches. Perfect. Then the ribbon rack on her chest. No more than an eighth of an inch between each ribbon. Perfect. He even lifted her jacket, making sure the side of her belt buckle lined up with the zipper of her pants and the flap of her shirt. A perfect gig line. "How do you really know her, Ziggy?" "I told you. Family friend. Like that Marine a few years back who went to your church in your hometown? You wouldn't let anyone work on that body. Cleaning, embalming, dressing. You did it all," Zig said, pulling a stray thread from the shoulder of the uniform. "Then another a few inches down. Then another. And another. 14 loose threads in total. Would anyone have noticed?" That wasn't the point. Even when someone requested cremation, Zig made sure every detail was perfect. "This was my job, Lou. Not Robbie's. Not yours," Zig said. "Besides, we've barely had her 24 hours. Since when do we rush people out so fast?" "Sue said she wanted to make room for the 6 new fallen who came in today." It made sense. Yet as Zig turned back to Louisa, he noticed she was still at her desk, like she was glued there. "You okay?" he asked. "Of course. Why?" Zig headed toward her, scanning her desk. "Who gave you the bag?"
"The what?"
"The bag," Zig said, pointing to the plastic baggie on her desk, tucked under her arm. "Those dog tags."
"These?"
"Yeah, they just came in," Louisa said, holding them up like she'd forgotten they were there. Sure enough, in the baggie were 2 beat-up dog tags, both labeled Brown, Nola. Just like the ones missing from the personal effects room, including the one that was cut from Nola's bootlaces. "Where'd you get these?" Zig asked.
"Colonel Sue brought them in a little bit ago. Said they arrived on this morning's flight with the 6 other fallen. Apparently someone found them at the crash scene. She wanted me to make sure the family got them."
Zig stared at Louisa, who'd still barely moved in her seat. He'd worked with her for over a decade. He knew she was tough, from that case where a young female soldier was murdered by an officer in Iraq. And it was Louisa, as she put the woman's organs back into her body and sewed her up, who figured out the woman was pregnant. Even the male morticians couldn't handle that one. Zig also knew how twisted and funny she was, remembering the story Louisa always told about how she got into this line of work. Her friend was dating a mortician who insisted that being an undertaker was a man's field, which made Louisa think that's where the money was. It certainly was, and still is, a man's field. But it wasn't until Louisa enrolled in mortuary school in Oklahoma that she realized how crap the pay was. Heart or no heart, Louisa had heart. Always. Didn't she?
"Don't look at me like that," Louisa said, finally getting up from her seat.
She was still holding the baggie with the dog tags.
"You think I don't know why Sue is suddenly showing interest?
All she wants is another excuse to brief the White House and maybe get a thank you from the President. I wanted to barf on her when I saw her out on the flight line this morning.
At a nearby table, Louisa slid the dog tags into a larger plastic pouch that held other personal effects, including the burned boots with the sliced laces.
"Can you help me get her ready? We need to close her up," Louisa said, motioning to the casket.
Before Zig could answer, there was a loud buzz, the doorbell from the outdoor loading dock. Louisa pushed a button on the wall, and the roll-top door at the far end of the room began to rise, revealing a shiny black hearse. Cadillac, brand new, that was here for the casket. Zig knew where it was headed. Longwood Funeral Home. The only question was, who'd be waiting at Longwood for it?
"All available personnel, report to the front for a send-off," a voice announced through the PA system.
Peering into the casket, Zig took one last look at this dead woman's face, at the thick makeup that made her so bronzed and beautiful. Still, as he did with every send-off, he couldn't help but imagine the pale gray skin that was lying just underneath. And now, for the first time in years, he was thinking of his last moments with...
"Zig, little help here?" Louisa said,
fighting to spread the protective plastic sheet back over the body. As Zig grabbed a corner of the sheet and tucked it over the dead woman's uniform, he noticed the brand new name tag on her chest, black with white letters, Brown.
Like so much in this case, it was, of course, a lie. Somewhere right now, Nola was out there. And somewhere right now, there's a family who has no idea their daughter is never coming home again.
"Wanna talk about it?" Louisa asked. Zig stayed silent. "I heard she's from your hometown."
"That she knew your daughter," Louisa added.
"That must be. I appreciate it, Lou. I really do," Zig said, taking one last scan of the casket and noticing,
there.
With his pointer finger and thumb, he tweezed a single stray hair from the white satin coffin liner.
"I think there's actually a molecule out of place if you look close enough," Louisa teased.
"Shh, I'm checking the protons and neutrons first," Zig teased back, though he was still studying the stray hair. Short and frizzy. An afro. The mortuary wasn't a big place. Only one man around here had hair like that. Master Guns.
It made no sense.
Master Guns did investigations. He didn't get involved with prepping and shipping bodies.
"If it helps. Sergeant Brown's lucky she had you working on her," Louisa said, shutting the casket.
It took a few more minutes to redrape the flag. In most cases, when a casket went out of state, it was put in an air tray, a massive container that would keep it protected on a plane. But Nola's and Zig's Pennsylvania hometown was only a short drive away. Unlocking the wheels of the metal casket cart, they pushed the flag-covered coffin toward the waiting hearse.
"Here for a pickup, Sergeant Nola Brown," the driver called out.
He was a kid, late 20s, military buzz cut and build, same as half the people here.
"I'll take good care of her," he promised, helping them navigate the coffin into the back, where it slid easily across the car's rolling rack.
Buzzcut slammed the back door shut.
"Meet you around front," Louisa said to the driver, who nodded as the hearse took off.
"Zig, you coming?" Louisa added, heading back inside. Right now, on the front side of the building, a young cadet assigned to serve as a military escort was waiting to join the hearse. Fellow Dover employees were also lining up along the circular driveway for a final goodbye, and the final salute that they gave every departing body. No one left the mortuary without a proper show of respect.
"Be right there," Zig said, still standing in the threshold of the open warehouse.
He waited for the hearse to disappear, and for Louisa to leave. Then he pulled out his phone and started to...
"Here for a pickup," a voice called out.
On Zig's right, a new hearse pulled up, a silver Buick with a black top, driven by a man with a bumpy nose and a mustache to offset it. The words Longwood Funeral Home were written in script on the driver's door. Zig felt a pressure on his chest. His arms went numb.
"Don't tell me you're here for Sergeant Nola Brown," mustache said.
He looked over Zig's shoulder at the now empty warehouse.
Everything okay, sir? I don't see Sergeant Brown's coffin.
16.
We're going to go to hell for this, aren't we?
Dina whispered.
You're already in hell. You work in a bowling alley,
Zig whispered as they approached the back of the hearse.
Yeah, says the guy who works in the morgue, by choice. Also, do I even want to know whose coffin this is?
Zig shot him a look, gripping the corner of the shiny wooden casket, which smelled like lemon fresh pledge.
Someone already came and took Nola's casket. Dover had plenty of extras. No one would miss this one, or realize what Zig was up to.
Okay, on three,
the driver with the mustache called out. He was crouched down on his knees inside the back of the hearse.
One, two.
With a single heave, Zig and Dino shoved the flag-covered casket into the car. The driver tugged from inside, then used the nearby straps to lock it in place.
That was lighter than I thought it'd be,
Dino whispered. Zig shot him another look. Wooden caskets weighed more than metal ones, but not when they're empty. It wasn't hard to pull off. With a phone call, Dino came running. He was the perfect distraction for the driver. From there, Zig reprinted Nola's paperwork, grabbed a new casket, and carefully affixed a freshly pressed American flag. He even added metal ID tags to the handles at the head and foot of the casket. Each one read, Brown, Nola.
And here are her personal effects,
Dino said, handing the driver a pouch filled with a set of keys, a cigarette lighter, and an old BlackBerry from the bowling alley's lost and found.
Got it. Great,
the driver said, marking it off on his own checklist and sliding into the front seat.
So I pick up the military escort around front,
he added. Actually, I'll be escorting today, Zig said, tightening his tie and pulling his blue blazer from a nearby chair.
I thought the escorts had to be soldiers, the driver said.
Or someone from Dover, Zig shot back. In this case, I knew the deceased. She's a friend of the family. There was a loud thunk as Zig slammed the trunk shut. Before he could reach the passenger seat, Dino grabbed him by the arm.
You know we can just follow the hearse in your car,
Dino whispered.
And tip off the people we're actually looking for. In case you didn't notice, they stole Nola's body. Then you should report that,
Dino hissed.
To whom? Colonel Sue? Master Guns? No offense. But for Nola to be rushed out of Dover that quickly, both of them had to have okayed it, or at least known about it, just like they did on the night she came in. Then track that other hearse, the one that took the body. When they drove off base, Dover cameras should have gotten a shot of their license plate.
Do you really think anyone will give me access to that footage? Pay attention, Dino. Whoever pulled this off, they're the same people who faked the fingerprints and rushed Nola's supposed corpse so quickly through the system. And they're the same ones who made sure her body was dressed early this morning and whisked it off an hour ago. And you know the only people who can pull that off?
The people who run this place,
Dino whispered, staring through the hearse's back window at the empty casket marked Brown, Nola.
Believe me, we may not know the why yet. But someone wants this body. We don't have a body. They don't know that. Whoever was in that other hearse, they're driving around with a casket. So when the Dover big board lights up and says that we just left the base with another casket that has another Nola body, trust me, they'll start wondering if they're the ones who got the fake. Someone's gonna come running. At the very least, by the time we get to Longwood, we'll see who's waiting for us at the funeral home.
If, Dino said. Zig knew what he meant. If Zig made it to the funeral home. For the better part of his professional life, Zig spent his days with the dead. He cleaned them, scrubbed them, cut their nails, and lovingly rebuilt them. But here, with Nola, a woman who was very much alive, it was Zig's first chance to actually save someone. Someone who once saved and helped him. And who he'd tried to help, too. Back then, he'd failed. Right now, she was definitely in trouble. He wouldn't fail her again.
You sure this girl's worth it?
Dino finally asked. Zig locked eyes with his old friend. He didn't have to say it. All set, Zig finally called out to the driver, sliding into the passenger seat and checking the side mirror to see if anyone was watching.
All clear.
For now. Next stop, Longwood Funeral Home, the driver from Longwood said, turning the ignition. Zig took another look at the side view mirror. Still clear.
From this angle, he had no idea what was coming.
17. Zig thought he was prepared. For nearly 2 hours now, as they headed up DE1, he'd been sitting there, fidgeting with his tie, counting the highway exit signs, bracing for this return to Ekron, his hometown. He knew so many memories were about to be stirred up, memories of his younger life, his married life, and of course, memories of his magpie. Ekron was where his daughter was born, where she learned to ride a bike, where she crashed, broke her other arm in dance class, where she hid in a tree for 4 hours during hide-and-seek. Zig actually called the sheriff, and a magpie revealed herself as the best of hiders. Where she threw up in the luncheonette. That was its name, the luncheonette, the first time she ever tried eggs. During the first few years after the funeral, Zig saw his daughter everywhere, whether he wanted to or not. These days, the opposite was true. Magpie was still there. He could always feel her there. But she was elsewhere, too. Off in the ether, until a conscious thought, a memory, a song, brought her instantly back. He could feel it right now. Her coming back, slowly, as they left the highway, as four lanes became two, as rural Delaware gave way to rural Pennsylvania, separated by a rusty mobile home on the Delaware side, and the scenery turned familiar. Maybe we should take Third Street, Zig offered. But it was too late, and they were there, rolling toward the one place he was hoping to avoid. The white headstones of Octavius Cemetery, where all those years ago, Zig buried his daughter. How old was she? The driver with the mustache. His name was Stevie, asked. Excuse me? Her, Stevie said, pointing a thumb over his own shoulder toward the casket in back. Sergeant Brown. What was she? 26? Stevie was in his 30s, thick fingers, crow's feet around the eyes. Even in a small town funeral home, there were plenty of things to squint away from.
I don't know how you do it.
What are you talking about? You drive a hearse, Zig said. Don't you see the same every day?
No. Here at Longwood, we get people in their 80s, their 90s. People who know it's coming. Sometimes we get a few like Walter Harris, who was 51 when he had his heart attack. And a few years back, we had this young boy who went swimming and...
Stevie stopped himself.
What a horror.
It was no different when Maggie was mentioned. People felt the need to editorialize with the same useless words. A horror. A tragedy. Can't imagine.
Regardless, cases like that are one in a million, Stevie added. But to do what you do at Dover, 20-year-old soldiers, just kids, every day.
He tried to finish the sentence, but again never got there. Zig nodded, now eyeing the passing headstones of the cemetery, all of them blurring together in a jagged line. He wondered if the groundskeepers put out the fresh flowers he paid for each month. He should check. He wanted to check. Wanted to see her. Usually he dreaded coming here. But that was the real secret about loss in the long term. After Maggie's death, it tore Zig apart to visit places like the Jersey Shore, where they used to take their daughter on vacation. Years later, though, a new trip to the shore brought back the best of memories. Flying a giant butterfly kite, finding her stealthily tucked away under a lounge chair during yet another game of hide-and-seek, and eating bad pizza and fantastic soft ice cream, a rainbow sprinkles mustache on her face, returning small pieces of her, like a reward. It was the same here today, Zig now flush with thoughts of the fall trees, all orange and yellow, when Maggie was born. Indeed, Memories that once ripped his heart open in the early days of loss were, years later, what eventually came back and comforted him. Zig was, for this moment, happy. It wouldn't last. "Final stop," the driver announced as they turned down Legion Drive and headed for the wide one-story gray building directly next to the firehouse. The sign was new, but the green and white script was exactly the same. Longwood Funeral Home. "Welcome back," Stevie said. Zig turned.
"How'd you know that?"
"Know what?"
"That I'm from here."
"You said welcome back. But I never told you that I lived here. That I worked here."
"I looked you up."
"Why?" Stevie pushed a button on the overhead console. The garage door of the funeral home slowly rose as the hearse rolled inside. "I asked you a question," Zig insisted, reaching for his knife. Inside, an automatic light popped on. There were stacks of orange traffic cones, a neatly wrapped rubber hose, and gallons of detergent for washing the hearse, which always needed to be spotless. On Zig's right were two metal coffins, both of them on steel casket carts. Stevie cut the engine, finally turning toward Zig. His eyes were two bricks of coal.
"You should go inside."
"What are you talking about?" Zig asked.
"Someone's waiting for you."
18. Zig knew that smell. Stale potpourri and carpet fresh. It was a trick of his old boss, a way to convince people they were coming to a real house as opposed to a house of death. As with nearly everything in a funeral home, it was another lie. "Anybody here?" Zig called out, heading slowly down the wide hallway that connected the garage with the rest of the house. His hand was in his pocket, on his knife. "Hello?" No one answered. Zig kicked himself for not seeing this coming. When the bodies of fallen soldiers were returned to their hometowns, the local funeral home was usually covered in flowers and American flags. People came out. Police cars and fire trucks greeted the hearse like it was a parade. Here at Longwood, though, everything was silent. When they first drove up, Zig assumed it was because Nola hadn't lived here in years, or that she'd changed her arrangements so recently. But now, it finally made sense. Someone here kept it quiet on purpose. "I'm here. You got what you want," Zig said, passing the stairs to the basement, where the embalming room was. He felt the old lump in his throat at the sight of the basement. He'd seen his first dead body down in that room. Actually, that wasn't true. At 11 years old, he'd found his grandmother dead in the big yellow easy chair in their living room. Her skin porcelain white, her eyeshadow bright blue, her perfume as potent as ever. Years later, Zig learned his trade in this basement. He worked on bodies in this basement, learned where to inject the embalming fluid in someone's cheeks so their smile was just right. Never too big of a smile. No one wanted a clown. Just enough for the pleasant look, his boss Raymond used to call it. And one day, in this same basement, Zig stood there, staring down at a zipped vinyl body bag, the corpse inside so small, it nearly looked empty. He'd told everyone he wanted to work on Maggie himself. The damage was so bad. His wife fought him on it, begged him, but he told her this was his privilege, that there was no greater honor than putting to rest those you love. It was, simply put, a disaster. As Zig unzipped the bag, just the sight of his daughter's light brown curls. That was it. When you lose someone close, someone who was bound to your soul, there's a moment when the tears come. Not the standard tears, where you cry and hug, and then the funeral's over and you go back to work thinking, I really need to make some changes and appreciate life more. No, these are the tears that sneak up on you, that catch you off guard and quickly swirl into a vortex in your throat and chest, robbing your breath and bringing on a cry like you've never cried before, a gasping, wrenching sob that rips at your belly, your core, at every belief you've ever held about the universe. Forget sadness. This was despair. Zig, on that August night, had that cry right here, down those stairs in that basement, standing over his daughter's body. It was a moment he was reliving now as he pushed through a closed door and found himself in the back of the reception room. There was a quiet click behind him. Someone holding a gun. Zig turned. She was tall and had pointy features, beautiful and sharp. Her hair was straight, white with a dyed single black streak. On closer glance, her white hair wasn't the color of things old. It was more silver, the color of the moon. She looked nothing like her old self, but there was no mistaking those black eyes with flecks of gold. No mistaking that scar on her ear. Hands. Now, Nola Brown said, aiming her gun at Zig's face.
19. This was Nola when she was 26. Empty your pockets, she insisted.
You think I'm armed?
He asked, flashing a grin. Stop talking. Nola didn't know this man. Had no idea his name was Zig. But she knew this. She didn't like charmers. And she didn't like him. Your knife, she said, pointing her gun toward his hip. Right pocket. Zig paused, looking confused. Nola saw it the moment Zig entered the room. At the first sign of panic, his hands didn't go to his waist, his chest, or even his ankle. All places for a gun. He went for his pants pocket. Pepper spray? No, he was too old. Probably too proud. Had to be a knife. On a nearby podium, Zig dumped his keys in his folding knife. A SOG Trident Elite. Big blade. Typical military macho-ness. Though the way his shoulders sagged, she wasn't convinced he was military. As for the knife, it was modified with a deep groove in the top of the blade so it could be opened as it was removed from his pocket. It also did extra damage, adding a puncture to every slice. Maybe he used it at work. Nola made a mental note. What about the key? She asked.
I gave you my keys. They're right.
The other key. The real one. She raised her gun to Zig's chest, but he barely stepped back. Barely even reacted. Like he hadn't even heard the words. She took a closer look at him. 50 years old. No wedding band, but still good-looking, a fact he was keenly aware of based on the way he jutted his chin, like he led with his face. Still, he had hair on his ears, plus a few strays in his eyebrows. Signs of a man living alone, or at least someone dating around so much every girl was too new to pluck them for him yet. What Nola noticed most were the dark circles under his eyes, like half-moons on his face. There was a twinkle in his gaze, but also an eerie sadness. And the way he was looking at her. No. Not just looking. Scrutinizing. Recognizing.
Nola,
he finally said. She stayed silent, gun still on him, finger tightening on the trigger.
Nola. It's me. I know you from when you're little.
He stepped toward her. He had a stillness about him even as he moved. A leader, but also a liar. I've never seen you before in my life. She pulled the slide back, cocking the gun and pointing it at his neck. Now give me the key.
I don't understand. The key for what?
For the coffin.
You mean the coffin you're supposed to be in? Wooden coffins don't have keys. There's just a latch,
he explained.
Besides, the coffin's empty. The body's gone.
Nola studied him. He did this thing before he spoke, touching his tongue to his right incisor. Sign of the truth or sign of a lie? Tell me what you want, she said. No tongue, no incisor.
I want to know what's going on and what happened to those people on the plane.
Had to be truth. And then, tongue to incisor.
Tell me that, and I'll show you where the body is.
Nola stood there a moment, motioning him toward her. As Zig got close, her hand shot out in a blur, palm up, her four long fingers straight like a spear, which she drove under his ribcage, aiming for...
There. His liver. What in the f-
The vomit came so quickly he never got the words out.
Hutch!
Gasping for air, Zig collapsed on his knees as hunks of his morning toast sprayed across the carpet. Nola learned that one from her dad, who once kicked her so hard in the liver she tasted blood. Stuffing her gun in the back of her pants, Nola stormed out of the room, back toward the garage. Zig yelled something behind her. She didn't care. Reaching the hearse, she ripped open the back door, revealing the flag-covered casket. At the foot of it was a metal nameplate. Brown. Nola. She stared at it, reading her own name twice, then tore the flag off the casket and yanked the casket toward her. Just from the weight, she knew. But still, she had to see for herself. She gave the casket another yank, then another, which, like a seesaw tipping, sent the casket falling to the ground. There was a dull thud as the foot of it hit the concrete. Click. Click. The latches were easy to find. The casket lid was heavy, but as she pried it open and saw the first hints of the satin liner inside, empty. Enraged, Nola slammed the lid shut, ramming it so hard it let out a thunderclap that echoed off the garage door and vibrated against her chest. Still, she never said a word, never screamed, never yelled. Silent Nola learned that long ago. It never did any good, especially when someone was watching.
Mongol, Faber, Stadler, Ticonderoga, Swan.
Nola mentally rolled through the list, using the meditation technique the psychologists gave her, for when the rage got to be too much.
Mongol, Faber, Stadler, Ticonderoga, Swan.
It wasn't helping.
You lied to me before, she growled. You have no idea where her body is.
You know, for someone who just made me spew all over the carpet in a funeral home, you really have an awkward way of saying I'm sorry,
Zig said, standing in the threshold that led back into the house.
That wasn't an apology.
So I gathered. I'm not your enemy here, Nola. I actually came to help.
Nola stayed silent, staring into the back of the hearse.
Mongol, Faber, Stadler.
Are you listening?
Zig asked.
You obviously paid the hearse driver to pick up the casket, which was a bust. Someone else took the body you're looking for. I'm offering assistance, and you've got nothing else to say?
Nola kept her back to him like he wasn't there. She was still staring into the hearse, at the metal rollers, at the straps, at the nicks in the leather, at the front seats, at the two cups of coffee in the cup holders. She pulled out a small notepad and pencil from her pocket.
What are you doing? Taking notes?
Zig asked. She was drawing. Always drawing, sketching, visually capturing the moment. Nola learned long ago this was how her brain worked.
Mongol, Faber, Stadler, Ticonderoga, Swan.
I'm guessing the woman from the plane crash. The one everyone thinks is you?
Zig said.
I take it she was a friend?
Nola didn't answer, still sketching, recreating in fuzzy pencil lines the open back door of the hearse and the coffin that was sticking out from it like a wooden tongue.
I worked on her, you know, in the mortuary. I took care of her,
Zig added, approaching the car. Nola whipped around, holding the pencil like a knife.
Easy,
Zig said.
I just...
He crouched, picking up the American flag that was on the ground. He started folding it carefully.
Sorry about the flag,
she offered. She meant it. Her whole life, Nola knew she wasn't like most people. Didn't even like most people. It was no different in the military, where during her first few weeks she was quickly singled out for stabbing a key into the hand of a fellow private who touched her ass. Still, in the army she found a consistency, a regularity that had been missing from her own uncertain life. Plus, they let her kill those who did harm in this world. And man, did Nola excel at that.
Can I ask you another question?
Zig said, though he didn't wait for an answer.
How come you haven't asked how I know you?
Again, no response. Apparently he wasn't as stupid as she first thought.
Nola, back in the room, when you first saw me, you recognized me, didn't you?
Nola kept sketching, head down. Mongol, Faber, Stadler, Ticonderoga, Swan. Maggie's dad, the mortician. Zig stood up straight.
Right there, Nola saw it. A flash of light in this desperate old man's face. He hadn't heard those words in so long he'd forgotten how good they felt.
Maggie's dad.
Call me Zig, he said far too excitedly as he extended a handshake.
Nola ignored it, still focused on her sketching. She had finished drawing the hearse and the coffin. She flipped the page, sketching something new, sketching Zig himself.
You remember saving her, don't you? My daughter?
Again, silence.
Listen, I meant what I said, he added. If you tell me what happened, I can help you.
Nola stayed quiet, her pencil a blur.
Can you at least tell me her name? Your friend. To be here, you obviously care about her, Zig said.
More silence. More sketching. The likeness was okay, a serviceable first draft. But as usual, her art, the actual process of drawing, it always showed her something more. She could see it in her rendering of Zig's eyes. Not just sadness. Loneliness.
Nola, you do realize someone took this woman's body. And if they don't know you're alive already, it's not gonna take them long to figure out.
Where's her body now?
I don't know. They took it.
Who's they?
No idea. We were waiting for the Longwood hearse to show up, but another hearse came in first, pretended to be Longwood, and swiped it.
So why'd you come here?
You switched to Longwood last night. I figured there had to be a reason why. At the very least, whoever was behind this, if they thought we had the body, maybe they would come running. I can tell you this, though. Whoever's doing this, I'm assuming it's the same people who faked your friend's fingerprint.
I need to go,
Nola interrupted, flipping her notepad shut. She hit the garage opener with her palm. The door yawned open.
My apologies again about the flag.
Nola.
No response.
Nola, please, wait!
Still nothing. She was already outside.
Nola, she left you a message. Your friend, in her stomach. I found a message for you.
Nola stopped mid-step.
What kind of message?
20.
And this was in her stomach?
Found it myself,
Zig said as they stood there in the closed garage. Nola looked at him. This was truth.
She must have swallowed it when she knew that the plane was, well, you know.
Nola nodded. She knew all too well. For 3 days now, she'd been replaying those final moments in Alaska when she was leaving the small airfield and suddenly people were yelling, crying. The wave of emotion so strong she felt it across the parking lot before she even heard it. People were pointing, sobbing. In the far distance across the plain of snow was a twirl of faint black smoke.
And that was all the note said?
Nola asked, staring down at the picture on Zig's phone. She read the words, then read them again. Nola, you were right. Keep running.
I assume that means something to you?
Zig asked. On screen, Nola enlarged the photo with her fingertips, studying the shaky handwriting and the bumpy stippling that comes from writing on an airplane's plastic tray table. She couldn't help but think about the moment these words were written, about the terror that propelled them. Nola had faced death before.
Most recently in a helicopter that was forced to make a crash landing in a cotton field in Yemen.
At the time, as the pilot was screaming things no one could understand, Nola's thoughts were about how she somehow expected a better death for herself. Something more meaningful than an inconvenient electrical short. Today, she wondered if her friend had a similar feeling as the plane went down in Alaska. Yet as Nola reread the note, a sadder truth emerged. In those final frantic moments, her friend wasn't worrying about her own death or even herself. She was worrying about Nola.
Camille,
Nola blurted. Excuse me? Zig asked.
Camille. That's her name. The woman on the plane. The body everyone thinks is me. Camille Williams. Staff sergeant assigned to Army Special Ops. 27 years old. From Iowa.
She was a friend? Nola turned toward Zig, giving him a good long look. But she said nothing. Nola, when you're on a plane that's about to crash, do you know the number one factor when it comes to who survives?
Be near the exit door,
Nola shot back. No, that's number two. Number one is, be a male. Yes, proximity to the exit door will decide who survives, but when the plane is going down and everyone rushes for that door, we become animals. We're always animals. To survive the crash, be a male, he said, his voice slowing down. Camille somehow got out. I'm wagering she was not a pushover. Now do you want to tell me more about her? Nola stayed silent, again hitting the button for the garage door, which again rolled open. She was leaving. I know you painted her, Zig called out as Nola headed outside. I saw the canvas in Camille's personal effects. It didn't slow Nola down. I also looked up your job. Artist in residence, that's what they call you, right? The Army lets you travel the world, painting soldiers in Afghanistan or relief workers in Bangladesh. You can go anywhere, can't you? Zig added. Yet what I can't understand is what you were doing out there in Alaska. Did you just go to paint Camille, or was there something else going on there? Nola kept walking. She didn't like Zig, didn't like the subtle tone of accusation in his voice. Can you at least tell me why Camille was flying under your name? You switched spots with her, right? Was that her idea or yours? Nola was outside, scanning the block and heading for the car that she'd hidden around the corner. What about Houdini? Zig said. Right there, Nola stopped. You think you're the only one who found the names of the other victims? Zig asked. Rose Mackenberg, Clifford Eddy, Amadeo Vaca. They were all on the plane with your friend Camille. But all three of them died 50 years ago. Nola stared down at the driveway, at a thin crack that zigzagged across the concrete. Not enough water in the cement mix. Such an avoidable error.
They were cover names, Nola finally said.
I know what cover names are. What I want to know is what they were covering. To be that far out in Alaska, this was a group that clearly didn't want anyone else around. Yet there you were, right at the center of it with your paintbrushes. So why don't we start over, Nola? You saw something out there in Alaska, something that I'm guessing made you stay off that plane. So, what was it?
Up the block, an old man was walking a far too small dog. The kind of dog that no one in their right mind would put on a leash. This doesn't concern you, Mr. Zigarowski. Have a nice life.
No, don't Mr. Zigarowski me. That note Camille left. Whoever took that plane down, if they were aiming for you...
I had no idea they were aiming for me. I still don't know.
But you've got a feeling. If you didn't, you wouldn't still be hiding like this. Or scanning the street like the boogeyman's coming.
Nola looked away from the street. Away from the man and his little dog. Zig was staring straight at her.
Nola, whatever's going on, you owe it to Camille to find the truth. I can help you with that.
I'm not 12 anymore. I don't need your help.
You sure about that? You're officially deceased. That means your IDs won't work, and neither will whatever classified security clearances you once had. At least with me, whatever doors you're planning to bang on next, you keep the element of surprise, which, far as I can tell, is the only thing you've got going in your favor right now.
Nola glanced back down at the crack in the cement. Why are you doing this, Mr. Zigarowski?
The same reason you changed your PADD and tried to bring Camille's body here instead of sending it to Arlington Cemetery. You wanted to get Camille to her family, didn't you?
That doesn't tell me why you're doing this.
Nola, I put people to rest. That's my job. So your friend Camille...
You keep calling her my friend. She wasn't my friend.
Either way, she's someone's daughter. She's a member of our military.
He looked Nola deep in the eyes, firing up the charm. With a quick lick of his lips, he touched his tongue to his right incisor.
I need to put Camille to rest.
Nola knew it was a lie. Or at least a half-truth. No way was Zig risking all this just to help some girl from his old neighborhood. No one would. So was this about what Nola did all those years ago at the campfire? Tackling Maggie? Was he doing this out of guilt or to repay some perceived debt? If so, he was more reckless and more wounded than she thought. But Zig was right about one thing. Nola's movements were definitely limited. If she wanted to figure things out, she'd need someone who could move around in the light of day, especially considering where she was going next. Nola thought about the pencil sketch she just drew of Zig, of the loneliness on his face. Did she like Zig? No. Did she trust him? No. But that didn't mean she couldn't use him.
How'd you like to go to Washington, D.C.?
Nola asked.
21. Fairfax County, Virginia. ID, the soldier insisted. Leaning an elbow out of the driver's side window, Zig teed up a grin and handed over his Dover mortuary ID. I have an appointment, Zig said, eyeing the guard, and the second guard behind him, both of them armed with MP5 assault weapons. At the front gate of most stateside military bases, including here at Fort Belvoir, the guards carried M9s, standard handguns. For them to have MP5s, they're on alert, looking for something. Or someone. You in yet? Nola asked in Zig's ear, through one of those Bluetooth earpieces that made him look part robot, part business traveler from 2006. Busy day, huh? Zig called out to the guards. Neither responded. The taller one, whose teeth were perfectly white but crooked like toppled buildings, was still studying Zig's ID. The other guard pulled out a long pole with a round mirror at the end of it and ran it under Zig's car. Even from here, Zig could see the airborne patch on his uniform with the sword and three lightning bolts. Forget military police. These were special forces.
2 years ago, my sister-in-law came through Dover, Crooked Teeth finally said, handing back Zig's ID. He pushed a button, raising the arm for the security gate. Thanks for what you do.
Welcome to Fort Belvoir. Zig nodded his thanks and hit the gas. Told you the Dover ID would work, Zig said to Nola.
She didn't respond. No surprise.
The entire ride here, silent Nola barely said a word. Was it smart for him to be here? Of course not. But was he breaking the law? Not yet.
Drive straight, Nola said as Zig weaved through the tidy streets, past the base's long white warehouses and red brick buildings.
Located half an hour outside of Washington, D.C., Fort Belvoir may look like a typical army base, but it housed some of the Defense Department's top secret keepers. The Army Intelligence and Security Command was headquartered here. So was the real-life Big Brother, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. To put it in context, Fort Belvoir had almost twice as many employees as the Pentagon. And in that final scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they put the Ark in the massive warehouse with the rest of the government's unmentionables, that's what they call this place right here on base, in the exact location Zig was now headed, the nondescript beige building with a sign out front that read, Museum Support Center, Center of Military History. Inside this wide government building was the cleanest air in the Washington, D.C. area, filtered down to the particulate level and kept at a perfect 70 degrees. To protect the treasures hidden inside, they even charged the air with positive static energy so that contaminants would be pushed out rather than stay inside.
Last space on the right has a blind spot, Nola said as Zig pulled into the parking lot and glanced up at the pole camera that apparently couldn't see him.
Keeping his head down as he got out of the car, Zig headed quickly for the building's glass front doors.
1083,
Nola added in his ear as Zig picked up the black telephone on the wall and entered the number into the intercom. It rang three times before.
"Barton here," a voice answered with a Kentucky drawl.
"We spoke earlier. I'm the investigator," Zig said. It was a lie, but not too far off. "From Dover?" Click. That was all it took.
There was a loud buzz. Zig shoved the door open. It was late now, almost 7 p.m. The wide atrium was dark. Everyone gone for the day.
"What's with the car?" Zig whispered to Nola.
In front of him, in the center of the lobby, was an antique automobile, complete with fancy spare tires on the side, like you see in old movies and Scrooge McDuck comics. "General Pershing's limousine from World War I. His locomobile," Nola said, even though she couldn't see him. The car was clearly a museum highlight. Zig cocked an eyebrow at her sudden helpfulness. The whole ride here, she barely said a word. Silent Nola in full effect. Though it wasn't just silence. Zig watched her carefully. Heart or no heart? Jury was still out. There was an impatience about her. A hidden rage. If she was now suddenly being talkative, she wanted something. "I need to ask you a question," she added. "Do it quickly. Your pal Barton is almost here."
"How badly was she burnt?"
"Who?" Zig almost asked. But he knew. The woman whose body he worked on yesterday. The body that was now missing, and that Nola was chasing. Camille. "She was flesh burned. Charter skin," Zig explained.
"Were they chemical burns or
not chemical?" Zig knew what she was getting at. When a missile hits a plane, people's skin will have chemical burns caused by caustic fuel. If it's a bomb, the body comes apart, creating fragments. Camille was intact, broken legs, burned on her right side only.
"You think she jumped?" Nola said.
"That would explain her legs. And with no signs of chemical burns or fragmentation,
no bomb, no missile," Nola said. She knew what was coming. That's why she ate the note. Soon after takeoff, maybe even during it, she knew the plane was going down.
Zig nodded.
"Can I ask you a question now?" he said, approaching the front grill of the limousine.
Up the hallway, a figure turned the corner. Zig didn't have much time, but with Nola suddenly being talkative.
"Tell me something about Maggie," Zig blurted. "My daughter."
There was a pause.
"Mr. Zigarowski."
"Zig," he insisted, forcing a laugh. "You have to call me Zig."
"I didn't know her well. I only lived in Ekron a year."
"Still, you did Girl Scouts together. And at the campfire. You saved her. I knocked her out of the way. That doesn't mean I... Who knows what would have happened if you weren't there? Thankfully, though, you were. And after that, you and Maggie... You walked the same halls. Sat in the same classes. You had to have seen each other somewhere. Just tell me one thing. Anything you remember about her." For a solid 5 seconds, Nola was silent. Until, "I remember her being in the car when you took me to the hospital. She kept saying thank you over and over. Otherwise, we really didn't spend any time together."
"Come on. Even just something stupid you might remember."
"Anything," Zig said, fighting hard to keep the pep in his voice. "Anything at all." Another 5 seconds. Zig was listening so hard, he started leaning forward, his shins pressing against the shiny front bumper of the limousine.
"It was a long time ago, Mr. Zigarowski. I'm sorry. I didn't know her that well."
Zig stared down at his own warped reflection in the chrome bumper, kicking himself for even asking. He wasn't new to this. Wasn't a recent mourner. Maggie died over a decade ago. His wounds had scarred over. No, he thought, had healed. His life was good now, and fulfilling. He was healed. "You must be Zig," a voice called out. Fluorescent lights popped on in the distance, motion sensors kicking in, lighting the hallway and revealing a paunchy little man folded like a dumpling. His plodding walk and bow tie said he wasn't military, but the way he was twirling his key ring like a gunslinger.
Administrator, Zig thought.
Barton Hudson, Nola whispered in Zig's ear.
Barton Hudson, the man said, offering a damp handshake. Through his gold-framed glasses, he had desperate eyes, eager for attention.
You like the locomobile, yes? Have you seen our Napoleon cannon?
Before Zig could argue, Barton led him back up the hallway toward a massive antique cannon that was nearly as big as Pershing's limo.
Named for its killing power, which explains why Uncle Sammy brought it here for the Civil War. Beautiful, yes? He said.
Zig, realizing he was one of those people who added yes at the end of his sentences to get people to agree with him.
His wife died last year, cancer in her kidney. He's got no one to go home to, Nola said in Zig's ear. Keep him on track, or he'll talk your ear off all night.
I really do appreciate you staying late, Zig said, glancing down the long cinder block hallway that had all the charm of a prison. Nearly half a football field down, the hallway dead-ended at a set of sealed metal doors. Even from here, there was no missing the white sign with bright red letters. Restricted area. Warning.
So about Sergeant Brown, Zig added. Of course. So sad. So sad, Barton said, giving another twirl to his key ring and heading deeper into the building.
Every 20 steps or so, more motion sensors clicked, lighting the hall with bright fluorescence.
Everyone here. We're all heartbroken.
He's a liar and a petty man, Nola said in Zig's ear. Tried to get me transferred every year since he first met me.
Such a tragedy, Barton added.
Cameras on your right and left, Nola warned as Zig counted no fewer than 4 ceiling cameras, as well as a temperature alarm, chemical reader, even a moisture monitor, like you see in the world's top museums. For well over a decade, the Army has been trying to open its own Army Museum. Until the funding came through, this enormous warehouse, tucked away at Fort Belvoir, was where they stored their best weapons and treasures, from thousands of antique and modern guns, cannons, bazookas, and every other armament, to flags flown in the Revolutionary War, to a rifle used at the Boston Tea Party, to frock coats worn at Gettysburg, to Ulysses S. Grant's Civil War cap, to the drum that the 3rd U.S. Infantry, the Old Guard, played at JFK's funeral.
He also fidgets when he's nervous, touches the arm of his glasses, twirls his key ring, Nola added.
So when was the last time you saw Nola?
Zig asked, watching Barton smooth his thumb against the length of a hunk of keys.
I guess last Thursday, yes?
The day she left for Alaska, Barton replied, weaving off the main hallway toward a door that looked like the entrance to a bank vault.
There were doors like this all around the building. Some protected military artifacts, others secured the Army's 16,000 pieces of fine art, from propaganda paintings by Norman Rockwell to watercolors done by Adolf Hitler himself, captured by U.S. troops during raids at the end of World War II. But of all the treasure-filled rooms in the building, this was the one he most wanted to see.
To be honest, I haven't been here since everything. Well, you know, Barton said, unlocking the door, shoving it open, and revealing a long rectangular room that smelled like paint and turpentine.
The sign read, Room 176, Artist Studio.
Here you go. Nola's office, Barton added.
Tell him to leave, Nola said in Zig's ear. Remind him you're investigating my death and that you...
Zig reached for his earpiece. Click. Call ended. A few minutes from now, Zig would tell Nola that there was no signal in the building, that his phone dropped the call. Would she believe him? Maybe. Did he care? Not at all. An hour ago, Nola asked him to go to her office to grab something she couldn't grab. But considering how many bodies had already shown up, and that Nola was the only one who somehow escaped the plane crash, Zig wasn't putting his life at risk without first investigating the one person who required the most investigation. Nola herself. Zig needed to repay her, and he might be sentimental, but he wasn't stupid. Heart or no heart, he needed that answer.
Best I get out of your way, yes? Barton asked.
Actually, before you go, Zig said,
Can I ask you a few questions about Sergeant Brown?
Sure. Of course.
2 hours from now, when they were cleaning up the blood, this is the moment Barton would remember. He'd wonder why he was so helpful to Zig, and why he let him in the first place. He'd ask it over and over. Would things have turned out differently if he didn't? But the truth was, nothing would have changed at all. The blood was always coming.
22.
Nola is, or rather, she was. Barton took a breath and shifted his weight, his whole round body wobbling. Nola's an artist. Zig knew that tone. No one likes speaking ill of the dead. That bad, huh? Zig said, adding a warm smile to keep him talking. She was just standing in the doorway. Barton stopped himself again. Nola was interesting. Sir, call me Barton. I'm civilian, just like you. Barton, then. Nice to meet you, Barton, Zig said, flashing a new grin, the grin he learned in his old life, when his job was to put people at ease so they wouldn't stiff him when they saw the final price of the casket and burial. Barton, at the start of my career, I used to be a funeral director, and I can tell you, people only use the word interesting when the deceased was a pain in the ass. Now I know it's tough, but this investigation, what are you investigating?
According to the news, the plane went down because of a mechanical failure, yes?
Absolutely, Zig said.